It's Monday, August 14th, 2023. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. A shocking election result in Argentina. Javier Milei, quite surprisingly, won the primary, putting him in good position to be elected in the fall. Described by the AP as far right, The Economist as libertarian, and The Guardian as a former tantric sex coach. He is a Donald Trump admirer, has named his five dogs after economists, including Milton Friedman, and he sports mutton chops like another iconic American hero to him, Elvis Presley, and also Milton Friedman. What fascinates me about Milei is not any of this, or not just this, but it's his slogan. Because for all the populist posing, we've seen many strains of that here and there and everywhere, from Brazil to Hungary, but check out the slogan. Viva la libertad, carajo! Long live freedom, damn it! Milei is not flexible. Milei is not a green. But you know who he's borrowing his motto from, right?
I am Gumby, damn it!
The more establishment bloc splintered the primary vote in Argentina, so even though he is at 30%, Milei is no shoo-in to win the presidency. Then again, percents aren't what they seem in Argentina with annual inflation of over 100%. I would not trust any numbers to hold as much as I would expect the sentiment, or at least the national cries of damn it, to persist. On the show today, we were just in South America. Let's go to South Africa and the rest of Africa, including Niger, or possibly Niger, depending on how you like to hear it pronounced. But first, you wouldn't take legal advice from someone who never attended law school. You probably wouldn't refer a football team comprised of people who quit football after their first year of Pop Warner. And yet, I've been listening to a podcast hosted by someone who doesn't watch horror movies. I should add, the podcast is about horror movies. How does that work exactly? Well, I will ask Allison Leiby, co-host of Ruined, who has reviewed, or at least given her opinion on, more than 100 horror movies for her podcast, despite only ever seeing 3 horror movies in her life. Allison Leiby up next. Allison Leiby is a writer, a performer, a striking member of the Writers Guild of America. Her one-woman show is called Oh God, a Show About Abortion. It was about abortion. And she has this very intriguing podcast called Ruined, the conceit of which is she and her co-host watch a movie, it's horror, and then they talk about it, except Allison can't actually watch the movies. She is so frightened by horror as a genre that I think she's seen only 3 of them. So it's a great podcast for people who love horror movies and people who never want to watch one but are curious about the plot and don't want to read about it in Wikipedia, would rather have some funny people explain it. Allison, welcome back to The Gist.
So nice to be here. Thank you.
Which 3 horror movies have you ever seen in real life?
So I saw, oh my God, now I'm like totally blanking on Jordan Peele's first movie, Get Out.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, I thought you were going to say that, you know, now I'm blanking if Sound of Music is considered a horror movie.
So I've seen Get Out. I've seen The Shining. Mm-hmm. And this one's kind of like we like fight about this with each other and on the podcast with other people. But Silence of the Lambs, I don't consider to be horror. Yeah. I do think it's more of a psychological thriller with there's some horror elements. And I will say I don't like those parts of that movie, but I really like that movie. Yeah. And that's pretty much it. I think there's like one more that we found out I had seen floating around like when I was little. But that's it. That's kind of the whole list.
Yeah, there are some maybe hazy lines between some genres, but I don't think of Silence of the Lambs as a horror movie either. There can be serial killer movies that are horror, but I don't think the Dahmer miniseries on Netflix was horror, but you probably didn't watch that either.
I didn't, though, not out of like necessarily like the fear of the content, but I was like, I just don't know. I'm not like the world's biggest true crime person either. I like my friend and I refer to talking about true crime. I'm like, I don't love a documentary about like one person who goes missing or like a mini series about kind of like a guy who murders a few people. Like I like big institutional crime shows. Yes. So like cults, you know, systemic issues that cause like massive, you know, it's like climate stuff, like that kind of stuff. That's obviously way more horrific than a serial killer.
Right.
I can get into.
So Stalin said one death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. But for you, a million deaths, that's when you maybe start tuning
yes.
in. One death is boring. Yeah.
I'm interested in that. And it kind of like takes me out of like, just like somebody getting stalked, like, which is very terrifying.
So I think about the three horror movies that you have watched, and they were mm-hmm. excellent. They're all excellent yeah. movies, and
yes.
I would think they would say, well, maybe you could give this genre more of an active try rather than just a passive listen. The Shining might commend you to other Kubrick movies,
yes.
or you might have said, maybe there's some other Stephen King, and you probably like Stand By Me. Maybe there's somewhere in the middle that's sort of horrible. But was it just that the scary parts were just so bothersome that you didn't come back to the genre?
Yeah, it just like always, I am someone who like weirdly like just will easily have a nightmare about something that I see or experience during the day. And I'm already kind of a terrible sleeper, so I kind of don't need more help staying up at night. I'm already doing that quite easily without horror. I do like respect horror and totally understand that like a lot of these movies are good. And there's lots of movies that I think it's like, you could see this, like you could get through this and be pretty fine. And maybe one day I'll watch those movies. At this point, I've heard the plot and the ending to all of them. So I'm yeah. not sure that because I do love a twist. Like that's kind of how the podcast got started, because Hallie loves these movies so much. And I was always like, well, just tell me the thing that happens, because I'm never going to see it. And I really do need to know what this big twist is. So to have a lot of that for so many movies that I know are excellent and that I think are possibly things I could handle watching, at least during the day, maybe. I think at some point I'll give a few other things a shot. But it just is a, it's not a genre that I personally enjoy, but I fully respect it so much.
Do you think that the twists that you've heard about play out to you in not the same way, but as surprising a way as they do the moviegoer? So I'll ask my question a little more coherently. The horror twists that really shocked moviegoers, are they consistently the ones when they're explained to you shock you? Or is it something else that you think is a good twist and maybe the people actually saw the movie said, nah, saw that one coming a mile away?
I mean, I am sure that the experience of viewing, because like I'm just hearing about it from my friend who's painting a fabulous picture of what's happening in the movie. Hallie is an excellent storyteller and a brilliant writer. So she's very good at it. But like, I think that there is something for if you're sitting in the theater, you can start putting together the clues by seeing what's on screen. But I think in general, like the big twists that people always are excited about are the ones that I've been totally shocked by when we do them on the podcast.
Oh, okay.
Where I'm just like, whoa, this is, what? They were dead? I thought that they were the whole time? Like, you know, obviously we've done the Sixth Sense.
Have you done Psycho on the show? Have you seen Psycho in real life?
We have done Psycho. I have not seen Psycho. I have seen a handful of Hitchcock movies that I studied in, I studied film in college as my minor. So like, I don't find those, like, I mean, those movies are upsetting in ways. And like, I've seen Vertigo, I've seen, you know, a couple of his other, Rebecca, was that it? Anyway.
Can you think of anyone who has as much expertise in an art form as you do in the art form of horror without having experienced it firsthand?
I don't think so. I don't think that there is anyone who knows as much about a thing that they've never seen than
right.
me. I will take that crown. I do think that I would have a hard time imagining anyone else.
So out of curiosity, with that in mind, I said to myself, I wonder if there are any famous deaf people who are experts in music. So not Beethoven turned deaf, but it has to exist. And it turns out the literature says, yeah, it's really common because of percussion.
Like, yes,
it's, and also people think of deaf as having to be total deafness. And then
right.
I said to myself, I wonder if there are any blind people who are docents at art museums. And the answer once again is yes.
Of course.
But I don't know if actually they hold a candle to you.
Yeah. I mean, we've done I don't know how many episodes we have out. I should probably know that offhand, but I feel like we've done like over 100 episodes at this point. We've done so many movies. And the one thing is like, we've done so many and so many of them get really similar that they do blur together in my mind because I haven't had the experience of seeing them myself. But yes, I do feel like it would be hard to find someone else with this kind of expertise in something that they actively don't engage with.
Have you written for shows? I know your credits are Life and Beth, Mrs. Maisel. Sometimes writers aren't credited.
Yes.
My question is, or what I'm thinking about is, would, you know, some offer come to you and it's something like something in your wheelhouse? It's a funny horror show. It's a socially conscious horror show. Sure. Or it's, well, let's say here's the hypothetical. Jordan Peele, who you greatly admire, and he represents a third of your entire horror consumption, says we're
really
staffing
does.
A TV show and we want you. You want to give it a shot. It's going to be in the horror genre.
I think I would do it. Because I wonder if the act of writing and, like, you know, writing is so, it seems so romantic, but I think we all know, like, it's not. It's just this very, like, do you want to spend 3 days talking about a 2-page scene and, like, unpacking every word? It really might kind of dismantle horror for me a little bit to kind of see how it gets made and turn it into daily minutiae and work.
Yeah.
In the way that Hallie's always, like, she was like, if you're ever watching something scary, just remember, like, you work in film and television, you know, like, these are actors. There was a call sheet. There's a PA off camera who has to go get, like, think about how mundane the work experience is.
The prop guy's like, oh, goddamn, the scary monster keeps malfunctioning.
Yeah.
And it's just a pain in the ass. It's a piece of metal with, some cloth draped on it. It's not really a scary monster. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a line producer who's like nickel and diming over the cost of a bucket of blood for the props to, like, there's like those things, like, it does take away a little bit of the horror of it all. So I wonder if writing it, if actively kind of being involved in the creation of it, would make it less scary, or if it might, who knows, it might make it more scary to me.
Well, you know, I wonder if people who just exist in this genre, if they are so expert at it, you know, from Stephen King on down,
right?
Is it that they still have the capacity to experience horror, or they just know where it is in other people? And there's an analogy I think that probably could be made with comedy, because I've been in comedy rooms and it's not, you guys are funny, right? And you understand where the joke is, but that doesn't mean there's usually a lot of laughter in a comedy room.
It depends on what you're working on, that's for sure. But I think about it like, you know, I do stand up, and I think about it with stand up. You know, they say there's jokes that are for the back of the room. There are jokes that the audience doesn't like that the comics will laugh so hard at that are standing in the back of the room waiting to go up, because you've heard, if you've done comedy, you've heard hours and hours of stand up every single night for however long you've done it. Like, you've heard it all. Like, I've heard every joke. I'm not saying that they still don't make me laugh, but like, you are deadened and you want edgier and edgier or more surprising or more different things. And I am sure, and I feel that as a comedian, I am certain that that has to be how horror works. That, like,
yes,
you see enough that you're like, I need more. I need, like, I mean, even just like the general consumer appetite, like, you know, Saw is not a movie they could have made in like 1961.
Right.
But, you know, now there's 10 of them.
But they did make The Hills Have Eyes in 1977, did
That's
they not?
True, and that movie sounds so scary. Did not like hearing about it.
So there are different subgenres of the genre, and there are different trends. And for a while, all trends in popular entertainment today are mostly based on what was the last thing that's successful, and let's try to do 100 versions of that. But I also do think, and I know from listening to the show that you agree, that to some point it's responding to the zeitgeist. So from what you've done, a lot of shows about toys, killer toys.
Yes.
And they're around. Child's Play was a big one in the 80s. Mm-hmm. What do you think was behind the rush to consider our toys deadly?
I feel like it probably came as a wave after, like, kind of this, like, consumerism boom in the eight. Like, I was a kid then, And I have family that was a kid kind of that are Gen X. And I feel like there was just like all of a sudden like advertising and consumption of like, you need all of these toys as opposed to like, this is my baby doll and that's my baseball mitt. And like, those are what we have. And it's like, well, you need Chucky, but then also there's my buddy and like all the different that like, right. That was one. I like
wherever he goes,
Teddy Ruxpin.
Do you remember my buddy's, my buddy's sibling?
Kid sister. I like can't even like really say those words without actually almost singing it.
Yeah. It's like the ABCs. Yeah.
My guess is that it would be that was part of it, that like we had this like huge, like, you know, television and advertise like in the 80s were kind of exploding in a way that it's like, well, here's a thing that we can't stop seeing every time we look at a screen or a magazine or a page. So let's make it scary. It's got to be part of it, but I'm sure there's some other, like, you know, parenting changed or something.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's hard. Do you think that there was anything behind the toy boom of the scary toys that
I think there are always those toy trends, but and maybe this just correlates to my life, but Cabbage Patch dolls became mm-hmm. this national obsession, and they're almost in that, like, they're just to the side of cute rather than mm-hmm. disturbing. So someone looking at a Cabbage Patch doll, maybe that he couldn't acquire, started to get resentful. And then we're wondering, I can't even get my kid a Cabbage Patch doll. Maybe, what if these Cabbage Patch dolls started stabbing people?
Yes.
And then we're off and running.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's a good theory.
Okay. So there were the killer toys. And then, again, the bad seed as a horror movie was, I think, in the 60s. So it's not like horror movies mm-hmm. invented this in the 90s. But man, was there a spate of creepy kid movies. What do you think's behind that?
Yeah. I mean, kids are creepy. So
there you go.
I don't know if there's like a trend or if that's something I always feel.
Well, I mean, you had an abortion, of course.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Kids are creepy.
So is that's it? Just the truth? We're finally able to admit kids are creepy.
I'm sure that there is, like, in horror, and I think it's true in, like, in comedy too, and just in any art, like, sometimes the thing that's around the most has the, like, everybody interacts with children. Like, we've all seen children at some point in our lives. And I do think that makes for, well, if we make it scary, everybody has experienced this. Everybody has seen a kid walking alone and you're like, what's that? What's happening over there? Like, I do think like the universality of it and like the simplicity and broadness like gives it the opportunity to actually be very scary because you don't have to over explain at the top what's happening. Like, you see a creepy kid, that's a creepy kid. Like, you're unsettled. There is, and then like you can just jump into like the fun that you want to have in the movie without this kind of big, okay, so you know what robots are? Okay, well, robots, if you haven't used a computer before, robots are like, you know, I think that there's just, you don't have to translate very much. It's just already there. And then you can just get to the fun.
Mm. So last thing I want to ask you about is this. There is the theory of horror movies that they serve as catharsis, that we have these horrors in real life. It's hard to deal with them. So if we put them in the fictional realm or even just the realm of the testing ground or the proving ground, it, you know, helps us as a people to process these difficult to deal with actual emotions. Sometimes that's just a highfalutin way to say, you know, to gussy up the fact that people like to be scared, like people like roller coasters. Mm-hmm. But assuming that's true a little bit, do you feel robbed of that?
I mean, Hallie talks about this a lot and how like she uses like horror is such a kind of band-aid for her anxiety, not band-aid, but like helps her anxiety because like in horror, there is often, I mean, there are movies that don't, but like a lot of it, it gets, the bad thing ends, it gets resolved. There is a beginning, middle, and end to horror that is, I mean, to all movies, but like just in particular, like the resolution feels very satisfying and that like kind of can feel calming when you feel like you don't have that resolution for the different things that are horrific in your own life. So I do, there is like a little bit of me where I'm like, that does feel like it might make me, like, I didn't see Hereditary, obviously, but I know that it is kind of about grief and about what that does to you and your brain and your life and your family. And it would be satisfying to watch something that is talking about that, that does end, even if that end is scary. When we meet, I meet like fans of the pod, or, you know, listeners, I hate saying fans, but like, everybody's like, I'm totally an Allison, or like, I'm a Hallie, I've seen everything. And it's like, there are, it is like a 50-50 split for like, at least when I talk to people, that like half the people that listen are like, I have seen one horror movie and I never, ever, ever want to again. And I've listened to every episode of your podcast. And I'm like, oh, it's just it's like, I'm interested. I want to know what happens. Like, I love gossip. Like, this is just gossip about undead people.
Allison Leiby is a stand-up comic writer. Her one-woman show was Oh God, a show about abortion. She still tours with that. And we've been talking mostly about her podcast, Ruined, which she co-hosts with Hallie Kiefer. Allison, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now the spiel. Niger, coup, neighbors upset, ECOWAS, the Wagner Group. It's all going on in Africa, where the African country of Niger, and that's how I'm going to say it, not Niger, I'll be saying Niger, the president, or former president, he's now under house arrest, Bazoum, he's arrested with his wife and his 20-year-old son. They are said to be locked up in the presidential palace, which is not bad, seemingly, but in actuality, they are in the basement of the presidential palace. They are running out of food, and not everyone's in good shape, the BBC reports.
The doctor's visit reportedly came as a huge relief to the president, his wife, and their 20-year-old son, who has a serious medical condition. Earlier, the UN human rights chief, Volker Türk, said the conditions of their detention were inhumane, degrading, and in violation of international human rights law. But despite the widespread condemnation, the military junta continues to hold Mr. Bazoum, presumably as a hostage, to make West African leaders think twice about military intervention.
The young Bazoum, the 20-year-old son, has a chronic medical condition, and he has also reportedly been denied care. The big Bazoum has also lost weight and is in worrying condition. The pressure for the restoration of the democratically elected president was, as per this next BBC report, coming from ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, which, more pertinent to this standoff, is not just an economic community, but also a military community. And here is the update on how ECOWAS, some call it ECOWAS, some call it Niger, where they stood before this weekend.
Countries from the West African regional body, ECOWAS, say they've now agreed on a plan for a possible military intervention in Niger if the military leaders who seize power there don't restore the country's president for the deadline. The deadline is Sunday.
On Sunday evening, a member of the junta's communication team told journalists that the regime had approved talks with ECOWAS that would take place in the coming days. A mediation team of Islamic scholars from neighboring Nigeria had planned to meet the junta over the weekend, and they were said to be open to dialogue with ECOWAS. So I guess what we need to do is just trust the junta. Everyone, take a deep breath and let the military junta do its job. Take them at their word. I'm sure the military junta can be trusted to. Oh no, here's CBS with an update.
Niger's military junta says it will prosecute ousted President Mohamed Bazoum for high treason. A spokesperson said yesterday that coup leaders had gathered evidence to prosecute Bazoum for, quote, high treason and undermining the internal and external security of Niger.
And what is the penalty for high treason?
According to Niger's penal code, if found guilty, he could face the death penalty.
NPR with the slightly too jaunty intonation there. So what have we learned? Junta is going to junta, or depending on your part of the world, junta. Nobody puts baby in a corner, but putting Bazoum in a basement seems to be working, sadly enough. And ECOWAS, a collection of West African nations which themselves have been toppled or threatened by coup, might not be the most credible intermediary. But if Niger wants to follow another African country, if they want another neighbor, not really a neighbor, 15,000 miles to the south, but if they want someone to emulate, maybe they should look to South Africa, because in South Africa, they don't depose their former leaders, then jail them. They follow procedure. They vote them out of office. Then they try them. Then they jail them. Only when Jacob Zuma was sent to prison 3 or 4 days ago, this happened.
It was a quick in and out for former President Jacob Zuma here in the Escorts Correctional Services facility. Zuma arrived here at exactly 6 o'clock in the morning. He was briefly processed and then released.
South Africa's News 24 on the penal toe touch from the former president. Zuma only served 2 months of a 21-month sentence before that, you know, minute and a half in jail. He was supposed to be serving a new sentence or the remainder of the sentence 3 days ago. But as you heard, he checks into jail. And then the current president of South Africa, Ramaphosa, announced a wide prisoner release benefiting Jacob Zuma, his immediate predecessor. Now, the two are rivals, though. They're also members of the ANC, but so is every president of the Republic of South Africa since Nelson Mandela, who famously spent approximately 9,900 more days in prison than Jacob Zuma. During Zuma's time as president, by the way, crime was out of control and prison overcrowding was a problem, thus giving occasion to his eventual release in the name of prison overcrowding. Way to not correct the problem that you would eventually benefit from. But enough of all this bad news from Africa, lest I give the impression that nothing good happens in Africa, I bring you these sweet sounds. Well, yes, actually, that is a man crying. His name is Tembu Abire, and he was trying to set the record for consecutive hours crying. It is part of a Nigerian Guinness Book of World Records mania. The head of the Guinness Book of World Records says he's gotten over 7,000 attempts from Nigeria this year, all inspired after a Nigerian chef, Hilda Basi, captured the imagination of the continent's most populous country. Abere, the crier, apparently did not officially set the record. He did say he temporarily went blind in the process of trying to cry for over 100 hours. But the point is, it's the indomitable spirit of a people, of a continent, of a giant, though not officially record-setting, crybaby. And that's it for today's show. Corey War is the GIST producer. Joel Patterson's the GIST senior producer. Michelle Pesca is CLO of Peachfish Productions and Peachfish Abatement. The GIST is presented in collaboration with Lipson's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Doom Peru, G Peru, Do Peru. Thanks for listening.